This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Singapore Summit, a historic first step toward the denuclearization of North Korea, or a propaganda win for a brutal dictator whose very power and authority depend on retaining a nuclear arsenal. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Either way you look at it, U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un entered the history books in Singapore last week as the first sitting leaders of their countries ever to meet face-to-face. Whether the mini-summit turns out to be truly historic depends on what comes next. The two men signed an agreement that committed both countries to work toward the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but the details remain vague. The document provided neither a timeline nor any details about how the North would go about giving up its weapons. It is unclear that Washington and Pyongyang even share a common definition of denuclearization. After the summit, President Trump apparently agreed to suspend joint military exercises with South Korea, part of what Seoul views as a bulwark of its alliance with the United States. In addition to potentially halting military exercises, Mr. Trump expressed a wish to one day withdraw troops from South Korea. Press reports indicate he did not confer with either the U.S. Defense Department or Seoul prior to making these statements. These apparent concessions on joint exercises and talk of withdrawing U.S. troops are exactly what Beijing, Pyongyang's patron, has been advocating, moves that Washington has previously rejected. Did the United States cede too much, both symbolically and substantively? Some analysts argue that Kim Jong-un, a brutal dictator of a nuclear-armed police state, could already claim a major victory by being granted a high-level one-on-one meeting and photo op with the President of the United States, the world's preeminent democracy, a feat which eluded his father and grandfather. Others remain cautiously optimistic about this unprecedented top-down diplomatic approach to combating the North Korean nuclear threat. More high-level negotiations over thorny issues like the pace of North Korea's denuclearization and a verification process to certify that the North has disarmed are slated to begin as early as next month. With us to discuss the results and implications of the mini-summit in Singapore are two distinguished analysts. Patrick Cronin is a senior advisor and senior director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And Harry Kazianis, he's director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest. He also serves as executive editor of its publishing arm, The National Interest. And both gentlemen are recognized experts on national security issues involving North Korea, China, and the Asia-Pacific. And both join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Patrick, let me begin with you. Your take on this mini-summit, is there any reason to believe that this effort at this top-down diplomacy with North Korea will succeed where other efforts in the past have failed?
We have no discernible evidence that it will. What we do have, though, is an opportunity with the third Kim Jong-un, to pursue a concrete diplomatic roadmap in the next several months to determine whether he will significantly dismantle his nuclear weapons. And there is a chance that he will. And certainly President Trump and Secretary Pompeo believe this is true. South Korean President Moon believes it to be true. So it's worth testing. But we didn't find any specific evidence out of the summit yet. They may have heard it, but we haven't seen it.
Harry Kazianis, your take.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in what Patrick said. I think the first thing that needs to be said, and I'm going to state the obvious, this is a diplomatic Hail Mary. And I think the ball is basically still in the air. We don't know if Kim Jong-un is going to catch it, but we're still waiting to see where the ball lands. I think for where we are at the moment, I think you have to give the president a lot of credit. We do not see a situation where North Korea is flinging ICBMs all across the Pacific, flinging missiles over Japan. We're not having threats of fire and fury or nuclear threats or potential attacks of Guam. So we are in a better space. But I think we all have to recognize that we are at a fork in the road when it comes to North Korea. In terms of the joint statement that was released, I think if you put that joint statement against many other joint statements that have been compiled in the six-party talks in the 2000s, they're very, very similar. And actually, the one that we signed is actually not as comprehensive as some of the other ones that have come out. So I think where we are right now is the summit is basically sort of inconclusive. I think we all looked at it as sort of the Super Bowl of foreign policy events. We all got very excited to watch it. We all liked the pictures. I was actually struck by seeing John Bolton shaking Kim Jong-un's hand. I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime. So I think we have to sort of now move past the photo ops. The question here, though, is North Korea really serious about giving up its nuclear weapons or not? And I think in the next few weeks, we're going to be able to answer that question.
Back to you, Patrick Cronin. Harry Kazianis said he liked the pictures. You know, some might disagree with that. The optics, some of the language Mr. Trump used to describe Kim Jong-un, a dictator who has starved his people, tortured his own people. How do you see the optics and some of the language? You know, the U.S. flag, the preeminent democracy in the world, side by side with the flag of North Korea. Others would say that was a bit jarring. And then Mr. Trump saying that Kim Jong-un loves his people, he's honorable, smart, etc. This also could jar many of those who are in these gulags and others around the world who are human rights advocates.
Well, Carol, I'm not here to debate the president's style. I think people have made up their mind whether they like it or dislike it. There's no doubt that his statecraft is unconventional, that he does oscillate from one view to another on any given moment. And as a result, he probably was a bit over the top in praising Kim Jong-un. He probably didn't need to go that far. However, in playing devil's advocate on what he just said, I agree with Harry. You've got to give President Trump credit for engineering this diplomatic attempt at a breakthrough and lulling Kim Jong-un into a relationship. This is the top leader, maybe the most powerful leader in the world when you think about concentrated power in one individual. And here we finally have a relationship directly with this leader, this third member of the Kim family who is running the country. And we had nothing until several months ago with the top leadership.
Harry Kazianis, to you again on the optics and language, but also about the apparent shift that Mr. Trump is trying to engineer, that is, the shift away from North Korea pursuing nuclear weapons and maybe going toward trying to develop a powerful economy. Do we know from this meeting if Kim is prepared to make this strategic shift? In other words, prepared to shift his country's strategic goal away from a quest for nuclear weapons and into a more powerful economy?
Well, first on the optics, Carol, I'm going to repeat what a North Korean defector I've spoken with for many years told me just recently. I asked him, what advice would you give to President Trump when he meets Kim Jong-un? He actually just said one word, Hitler. And the way he sort of parsed that is that the Kim family, according to many Koreans, is essentially three generations of Hitlers. They're responsible for the death of millions of Koreans, responsible for starting the Korean War, which cost many Americans their lives. My father-in-law and my grandfather are actually veterans of that war. So for many Koreans, this is a very ingrained and very, very thorny subject. And we have to be honest and be very clear. The North Koreans are human rights monsters. You can't sugarcoat that in any way. So I think we have to state that up front. In terms of the optics, yes, I was uncomfortable seeing the North Korean flag next to the Stars and Stripes. That didn't bring me any cold comfort. But unfortunately, the United States has to have relations and talk to people that we do not share the same values with. That's terrible, but that is the world we live in. In terms of North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons in terms of exchanging for economic benefits, North Korea does have a lot of natural economic viability. And just to give you an example, Carol, North Korea, it's been estimated, is sitting on trillions of dollars of minerals, natural resources. I've heard reports that they could have oil fields out in their seabeds. So just in that alone, North Korea could become someday an economic powerhouse if they chose to. But the fundamental question that Kim Jong-un has not answered for us yet is if he is willing to give up his nuclear weapons. We have to think of it this way. We know that the United States is not going to attack North Korea if they're sitting on as many as 60 nuclear weapons, because they would be able to obliterate Seoul, Tokyo. They'd be able to kill potentially hundreds of millions of people in an all-out Second Korean War. So that is the fundamental question. And I think, again, in the next few weeks, we will get an answer. And if that answer is not the one we're looking for, we are going to have to recalibrate our policies.
Quickly to you, Patrick Cronin, about whether or not you think Kim is prepared to shift his country's strategic goal away from a quest for nuclear weapons, which we know he already has, but further consolidating that into a more powerful economy, such as Mr. Trump tried to argue.
Well, it's a great question, and I just finished a large report with a North Korean economic expert, Bill Silverstein. It'll be on our webpage next week. And you have to look at the economic and diplomatic dimensions of North Korea in tandem. So it's a very important thing to consider. We can't really understand what Kim is doing in 2018 in terms of diplomacy without looking at his economic aspirations for North Korea. He really does want economic development. But as Harry suggested, we don't know whether he's willing to give up something for it, namely his nuclear weapons. Apparently he's told our leadership and South Korean leadership that he is willing, but words are cheap and he hasn't said it even in a written document. So this is what we're looking for in the next several months, maybe it's more than a few weeks, but probably by the end of this year, we'll know whether he wants to disclose his nuclear inventory, wants to start dismantling some significant aspects of that in exchange for that economic development. How much does he want it? If he wants it enough, he should be willing to do this. This is at least the argument that's being tested with him right now.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Patrick Cronin. He's senior advisor and senior director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, from whom you just heard, and Harry Kazianis. He's director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest. We're discussing the promise and peril of the Singapore summit between the United States and the North Korean regime. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now here's a shout out to a loyal listener who sent an email to us, Jaya Prakash from Coimbatore, India. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guests and our discussion about the Singapore summit. Let me turn to you, Harry Kazianis, and talk about this word denuclearization. That is a very thorny issue, but at the heart of what we're discussing. And many analysts say that the United States and North Korea do not really share a common definition. You know, when we talk about denuclearization, we're talking about North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons. But we don't know if they share that same concept. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, this is one of those issues, Carol, where it's like two people looking at the sky and one saying it's not blue. I mean, that's literally where we are in terms of this conversation. I think it's very clear what the United States is looking for and what the definition is. That means that the North Koreans would surrender in some capacity all of their nuclear weapons. Before that, they would lay out to the United States the scope and scale of their nuclear program, how many scientists are part of that program, how many facilities they have. And in a process that would probably take years, probably take thousands of people, probably take billions of dollars, start to break that infrastructure down and make sure that they are unable to build any more nuclear weapons. On top of that, once that process is all done, you would need to leave inspectors on the ground to verify that they are not cheating on that. Now, that would be a tall task. We have to remember the North Koreans have more than likely many different installations that are underground. We have to remember North Korea is a decently large country. It's mountainous. It would not be easy to fully verify everything that they're doing. So there is a propensity the North Koreans could cheat. On the other hand, the North Koreans, they've committed many times to the word denuclearization, but they've never actually done it. And that's the problem.
Indeed, that's the problem, Patrick Cronin. They've promised denuclearization in the past. They've reneged. Then there's the problem of having already this knowledge, know-how, how can one undo all of that, let alone the huge task that Harry Kazianis just laid out?
Well, the answer is you can't, and officials on both sides know that. So the rhetoric here is not quite realistic. The reality is that what's being negotiated is the terms of dismantlement and the scope of it, and then what are the concessions in return for it. So complete disarmament or denuclearization is the phrase that was actually used in the summit agreement. And then Secretary Pompeo has explained that that, of course, includes, in his perspective, and he thinks Mr. Kim understands, it's verifiable and irreversible. The reality is there's no such thing as irreversible, but we can manage down this nuclear program. We can, with the right kind of verification scheme that Harry outlined, really reduce the risk of a breakout strategy. And that's the best we can do. And that may be worth buying, in effect, with the idea that we're aspiring for CVID, complete verifiable irreversible dismantlement or denuclearization, but we can never know for sure.
Turning back to you, Harry, let's take a look at what Mr. Trump said about halting joint preparedness exercises, or what he called, quote, war games with South Korea. Now, this has worried many experts who think that this might be going too far too soon without any verifiable action on the part of North Korea. Heretofore, Washington had rejected this type of quid pro quo.
Yeah, I was a little taken aback that the president sort of offered this up and he hadn't talked, at least according to the time, to South Korean allies and others. So it was a little bit shocking. But I think what the president's strategy here is very simple. I think he has tried to have this summit with Kim Jong-un to draw him out, to understand if he is willing to denuclearize or not. One of the things the North Koreans are always terrified of is these different military exercises. I'm not exactly sure why, but their interpretation is that they could be the prelude to a war, to some sort of bombing campaign. They get very nervous when our B-2 bombers, B-52s, get close to their airspace. So I think what Trump is trying to do is to take all of the things off the table the North Koreans claim to be nervous about, to bring Kim into the international community and say, look, we are opening the door wide open for you, but you're the ones who have to walk through it. And this will test the North Koreans' intentions. And like I've said, in the next few weeks, maybe even months, as Patrick said, we will get an idea if this is what they want to do. Now, if we get to the end of this process and they don't want to do that, we are going to have to figure out what it means to live with a nuclear North Korea. Now, I'm not saying accept it, Carol, but to figure out what our strategy should be.
Turning to you, Patrick Cronin, for your reaction to this statement. Some critics have said it's like Mr. Trump was actually using Chinese talking points because the Chinese are the ones who have been advocating that the United States and South Korea need to halt these military exercises, which we argue are defensive in nature. What is your reaction to this statement, and are you worried?
I'm not worried yet, and I do agree that this is the type of decision that should be coordinated with the Secretary of Defense and with allies in advance. But having said that, if you think about what the president had to offer Kim at the summit, other than a summit itself with the American president, which was a concession in itself, it was some suspension of a war game, of an exercise that was going to probably be scaled down radically this fall anyhow, assuming diplomacy was happening. The president knows that he can scale this right back up very quickly. So by next spring, we'll be back with major war games if we have not been sort of justified in testing Kim during this latter half of this year. So I think this was the one thing that he could play. He played it. He knows he can reverse it. I hope he fully understands, as Secretary Mattis and other key officials in the administration do, the value of our forward presence for not just South Korea and Japan, but for U.S. national interests and regional security.
Well, back to you, Harry Kasianis, to talk about how China sees this summit. Did it come out sort of a winner at the expense of the United States, or is it a win-win? How do you see how they perceive the results so far?
Well, Carol, there's been a lot of commentary that China is the winner in this. I don't think we can make that call yet, to be honest with you. Thinking about this very broadly, I think one thing that could be in the back of the Trump administration's mind is if they were able to sort of detach the North Koreans a little bit from the Chinese. I mean, look at it from the North Koreans' perspective for a moment. 90% of North Korea's exports go through China. So they are highly dependent on the Chinese for pretty much anything that they want to do. Quoting one Chinese official I spoke to a few years ago, he said, "We could end North Korea if we wanted to within a few weeks." And I think the North Koreans truly see that as a threat to them. Now, I think we're very far away from the day when the North Koreans would be sort of in the U.S. camp. But I think if you look back at North Korean history, one of the things they did really from the 1950s to the 1980s is they would play off the great powers against each other, the Chinese, the Russians, trying to get aid for both of them. So I think the Chinese look at this and they're like, we don't want a war. We don't want more missiles or nuclear testing. They want stability. And I think they're willing to look at it from many different perspectives. I think the one thing they want to ensure, though, is that North Korea stays in their camp because they like that nice buffer from U.S. forces.
So, Patrick Cronin, do you think the Chinese come away, at least preliminarily from this summit, as, well, we have more leverage now? Mr. Trump is even using language that we use with respect to the joint exercises. And then they're also talking about potential relaxation of sanctions. How do you see China's perspective on this and how they gained or didn't?
Well, I've been in the region four times in the last 6 weeks, and I've talked to many Chinese friends, and I think they're quite divided over the role they've played. On the one hand, they want credit for having enacted the sanctions to put the pressure on Kim to come to a summit in the first place. On the other hand, they feel like they've been marginalized. And if you saw the improvisation of Beijing in March, after President Trump came out of the White House with the South Korean National Security Advisor and National Intelligence Chief and announced that he was going to go to the summit with Kim Jong-un, you could almost hear Beijing scrambling to invite Kim, something they had resisted doing for the last 6 years because they were completely estranged between Pyongyang and Beijing. She and Kim do not like each other. There's great animus there that I could go into if we had time. But the point is, they've had to make up quickly in 2018 because it's in their interest to have a partnership as North Korea negotiates with the Americans for the first time and as China wants to retain that influence that Harry's talking about and that this is part of their sphere of influence. So they're fearing the loss of that. And I think they do fear that Trump could turn Kim into a more balancing partner. Not that he's going to be an ally of the United States, but like every other Asian country, fearful of China's power, they want sort of an outside balancer. And the United States could actually provide that. Now, that's a big if, right? We've talked about human rights, we've got denuclearization, so we're getting ahead of it. But if you're thinking out loud about the next few years, yeah, this is a Chinese fear.
South Korea, Harry Kasyanis, Moon Jae-in, he's the one who's the motor behind this whole process. He invited North Korea to the Olympics. They stepped over the DMZ and met prior to this summit. How do they see this summit? A success? Failure? Mixed?
Well, I think we have to really think about South Korea's perspective on all this because this is an existential threat for the South Koreans. If there was a war between North Korea and South Korea, it's pretty plausible that millions of South Koreans would die. Seoul would be basically turned to atomic ash. So for them, any sort of progress, any sort of easing of tensions is good. I think President Moon went into this as trying to figure a way to sort of bring the North Koreans out. I think he's been very successful. I think for the South Koreans, their goal more than anything else is to try and be a bridge between Pyongyang and Washington. I think they've accomplished that. And I think now what President Moon is going to do is he's going to still be in that role of trying to keep that bridge together. Over the next few weeks, we're going to see some differences of opinions between Pyongyang and Washington as they get into these much more tougher negotiations. In fact, we're already seeing different opinions in North Korean media stating that, oh, President Trump has declared that he's going to start lifting the sanctions, whereas Mike Pompeo is saying that, well, no, we're not going to do that unless you start denuclearizing. So it's going to be up to Moon and the South Koreans to sort of smooth these gaps and bridge these gaps. And I think that's important.
South Korea, Patrick Cronin.
Moon Jae-in had more to lose out of this summit than anybody else. North Korea and the United States can go back to being enemies, and they're happy with that. Moon is fully vested in this diplomatic peace process. He has four more years of his one-term tenure. He is the peace president of South Korea, and he is now riding very high in the polls and came out of Singapore was exactly what he had helped to engineer very carefully. He's choreographed this whole thing in many ways. So Moon is the big winner tactically out of this, but he'll be a big loser if this whole thing falls apart as it has in the past with North Korean negotiations.
Japan's Shinzo Abe came to Washington prior to Mr. Trump going to Singapore, Harry. Very worried. What does Japan get out of this?
I think Japan is, unfortunately, the loser in this situation. And I say that very reluctantly, because as my Japanese colleagues have reminded me that their goal in all of this is to truly see that CVID, or the complete verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea. It's a mouthful. But they also want other things, too. We have to remember the geographic proximity to North Korea means that they would face the full spectrum of North Korea's capabilities. Not only 1,000 missiles, not only nuclear weapons, not only chemical weapons, biological weapons. So for them, their interest in seeing North Korea de-armed is very, very high. And I think there's a lot of angst and a lot of upsetment in Tokyo. They're not voicing it just yet, but they are concerned that the Trump administration will settle for something less. Would it rupture the alliance? I don't think so, but I think you would see Japan start to increase its military spending, probably pretty dramatically, increasing their missile defenses. And I think that would cause a lot of other Asian nations to also consider doing the same.
To you, yes. Patrick, about Japan and their angst and upset.
The concern of Japan and other allies and partners in the Asia-Pacific is reliability. Will President Trump be a reliable defender of their interests? And they're not sure because there are trade tariffs, because Abe has been the best friend to President Trump, and yet he's been also distanced, not just from the trade front, but also in TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership initially, but also now not really getting his way in the North Korean talks. I think the Japanese are really fearful that if we left the peninsula with our troops, we would really have a weak U.S.-Japan alliance, and that would expose Japan. Japan is fully sort of dependent on a close, strong U.S.-Japan alliance to be able to compete with a rising China. And if they don't have that, in addition to dealing with North Korea, they're going to have to consider Herculean moves like developing a nuclear weapon, which they don't want to do. But something like that may happen in the future.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We will definitely return to this important topic of denuclearizing North Korea in the coming weeks and months. I'd like to thank my guests, Patrick Cronin, Senior Advisor and Senior Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.